There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think, I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shack of a sauce bottle, mate.
G'day and welcome to ANU's Democracy Sausage with me, Mark Kenny. And before I go any further, can I just raise the subject of Angus Blackman? I should have done this last week. It was his last podcast as executive producer of Democracy Sausage. And I had intended actually to drag him in from the control room and have a quick word with him so that you could meet him as well. But he, unfortunately, I didn't do that. It slipped my mind. We were sort of over time and I should have done that. I hope that he'll accept my apology for that. But can I just say he was always dedicated, even-tempered, exacting in his standards, really across what was happening in both the university and in the broader academy and, of course, in the public realm and the sorts of issues that we like to discuss. So it was just so terrific working with him. Between he and Martin Pierce, the original executive producer of Democracy Sausage, I have been extremely well served. I know my colleague Maria Tafalaga, who, as you know, is now on maternity leave, but I know she would share this view as well, that we both really loved working with Angus. He's gone off to higher things, at least higher income things, hopefully, and good luck to him. But if I could just make that point, that we really, really appreciated working with him, and his loss will be felt. Now, this week, we're speaking to one of Australia's most eminent and erudite strategic and defence policy experts, Emeritus Professor Hugh White. And we're talking about AUKUS, the Naval Surface Ships Review, strategic planning issues, and a range of other things. So, Hugh, welcome back to Democracy Sausage.
Nice to be with you.
It's always good to talk to you. And in fact, I think last year when we spoke, it was one of the highest rating Democracy Sausage podcasts for the year. So,
Was it? I'm glad to hear that.
So I'm going to cling on to your coattails again and see if we can
do better this year.
Yeah, that's right. So the government last month released its naval plans, or at least its naval shipbuilding plans, this sort of surface ships review, which found, and it had been commissioned because there was doubts about a whole range of things. There's a huge amount of money involved in naval acquisitions, of course, in shipbuilding, and not just money, but also big implications for effectiveness. Now, the review found that the current way we've configured our Navy and what we have planned for surface ship acquisition is not fit for purpose. Now, that's a pretty common phrase we hear. I guess it raises the question, what is the purpose?
Yeah, well, that's a really good place to start because, you know, our political leaders on both sides of politics keep on saying that we face the most demanding strategic circumstances since the Second World War. And it is just worth, you know, unpacking that a bit. You know, is it true? And
what does it mean
if it's true?
Yeah.
Look, I happen to think it is true. And indeed, we may be facing the most serious strategic circumstances, not just since the Second World War, but maybe in our history. And the reason for that is pretty simple. That is, for the first time in our history since European settlement.
Yeah, because I think the biggest historic threat happened because of European settlement.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's always worth bearing in mind that, you know, the history of Australian security goes back before 1788.
Yeah.
But if we think of the way in which the society that now occupies this continent from 1788 has seen its security, ever since 1788, Asia has been dominated by Anglo-Saxon powers, first Britain and America.
Mm.
Only once in that time, between roughly speaking 1930 and 1945, has that position been seriously challenged by an Asian power, and that was Japan. That challenge went away. Now we face a challenge from another Asian power. China does seek to push America out of Asia and become the leading power, take its place as leading power in East Asia and the Western Pacific. Its challenge is very serious because it's far more powerful relative to the United States than Japan ever was at the height of its power. And, of course, the other point is it's not just China, because there's another Asian rising power, India, and maybe even a third, Indonesia. We'll have the fourth biggest economy in the world by the middle, well before the middle of the century.
Yeah, I think it's just about to become the sixth largest
economy.
Yeah,
that's right. It's just about to trip over that. And so, you know, we are now living in an Asia and will increasingly be living in an Asia in which the preponderance of the Anglo-Saxon powers can no longer be taken for granted, our great mates, our great and powerful friends. And what's more, the challenge, particularly at the moment, that China poses to America is a quintessential great power, power politics challenge. And although history shows that those sorts of challenges, you know, rising power meets an established power and tries to knock it out of the way, history shows that those sorts of challenges don't always lead to war, but they very often do. Mm. And this time we're talking about, you know, a contest between the world's two strongest states about which of them will be the dominant power in the world's most dynamic and prosperous region.
This is
the stakes don't get any higher.
This is the so-called Thucydides trap.
Thucydides trap, exactly.
And the argument is that the power that is being challenged is not going to simply give up power. It's not going to simply say, welcome aboard, how much power would you like to share?
Exactly. And, you know, Thucydides said it was the rising power of Athens and the fear that created in China that made war inevitable. Hmm. He probably didn't mean inevitable, but it is a genuine fear. And the fact is that I think the contest between the US and China is one that is particularly fraught and dangerous because I think both sides tend to doubt the other's resolve. If both sides are sure that the other will go to war if they don't get their way, then the imperative to compromise is pretty high.
Yeah, there's a sort of an implied equilibrium
exactly,
that comes about.
Exactly,
as a result. Yeah.
Which is exactly what happened during the Cold War, oddly enough.
Yes,
that's why it stayed cold. But where
that's mutually assured destruction.
Exactly. Yeah. But both sides were convinced throughout the Cold War that the other would go to the mat, fight a nuclear war, in fact, in order to preserve their position vis-a-vis the other.
Yeah.
But when China looks at America today, I think there are real doubts in Beijing's mind that America is, in the end, despite what it says, actually willing to fight to preserve its position in the Western Pacific, for example, actually prepared to fight over Taiwan. And I also fear that there are plenty of people in Washington who somehow delude themselves that the Chinese wouldn't be willing to fight to push them out. And so I think we do have a kind of situation where both sides are inclined to underestimate the resolve of the other.
Can I just stop you there? Does Beijing, do you think, see the maintenance of a US friendly government in Taiwan as essentially a proxy for the US? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly right. Look, ever since 1949, ever since the communists came to power in mainland China, Taiwan's separateness from Beijing, its standing aloof from rule from Beijing, has been seen both by Beijing, by the communists in Beijing, and by Washington as the symbol of America's continued strategic weight in East Asia and the Western Pacific. That's why Taiwan has always been a highly neuralgic issue.
Yeah.
Now, it became less neuralgic in the happy times between 1972, roughly speaking, when Nixon went to China, and, say, 2010, when China started flexing its muscles again.
And during which period there was this assumption that China was sort of slowly but surely moving into the international community, into the so-called rules-based order,
exactly.
Sharing its own, you know, this whole developing nation
That's
ethos.
Right. There was a strong sense that as China grew rich, it would grow more like us, and therefore, like us, the West.
Yeah, like
and
would trade would liberalise
that's
it,
right.
that political liberalisation would
sort
come.
There's a very strong sense that your economy couldn't grow very far without becoming more democratic.
Mm.
And the Chinese have proved that wrong as they've proved a whole lot of other things wrong.
Yeah.
And there was also the assumption that as it became more democratic, it would also become more willing to accept American primacy as a foundation for the Asian order. Now, that always seemed to me to be highly implausible. You know, it's a crude analogy, but I think it has some weight. America would never accept China as a dominant power in the Western Hemisphere. Why would China accept the United States as a dominant power in its part of the world?
Yeah.
You know, it really is almost as simple and sort of primal as that.
It's interesting when you think about this, to think about Cuba and what that must have been like.
Well, exactly.
Speaking of the Cold War, that was one of the flashpoints in 62, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. I mean, America has actually declared and enforced a sphere of influence, an exclusive sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere, roughly speaking, since 1824.
Mm.
It's why it's called the Monroe Doctrine after President Monroe. And so, you know, it's hardly surprising that we're seeing this rivalry develop, but it does seem to me that uncertainty about the resolve on each side makes a conflict more likely, because it means that each side is inclined to push ahead into a crisis expecting the other to back off. And if both sides push into a crisis expecting the other to back off, then they're going to clash. The really creepy analogy is not so, in other words, with what happened in 1938 or 1939 or in the lead up to the Second World War, which what happened in 1914,
yes,
where everybody went to war expecting the other guys to back down, and none of them did.
Yeah, so it's like this major sort of miscalculation.
Major miscalculations, that's right. And so, you know, in a crisis over Taiwan, I think the risk is that China will decide at some stage, and I think this risk is quite high, that China will decide that it can afford to push militarily against Taiwan, not necessarily an invasion, maybe a blockade, because it expects the United States to back off, and the United States doesn't. And the United States decides to push back because it expects the Chinese to back off, and the Chinese don't, and therefore they clash. Now, that's a war that would be unimaginably devastating, and I think quite likely to become a nuclear war. And so for all those reasons, I think our political leaders are quite right to say that we live in the most dangerous times since the Second World War. And I think arguably they're understating it. The other point to bear in mind, though, is that I think by far and away the most likely outcome of this contest is that the United States will end up withdrawing from East Asia. And we therefore face the challenge, again for the first time in our history, of thinking about how we make our way diplomatically and militarily in an Asia which is no longer dominated and made safe for us by our Anglo-Saxon mates. And so when we think about our present defence posture, including our surface fleet and our submarines, the two questions, one is how should we be thinking about the prospect of US-China conflict on the one hand, and the second is how should we think about what we need to make ourselves safe in an Asia which is where we really are for the first time in our history by ourselves on the other. And you know, I think that that's one of the reasons why, quite apart from the diplomatic challenges we face, I think the challenges to Australian defence policy today are as grave as we've ever faced.
It's really interesting, because if you accept all of that, which I do, you could arrive at two different conclusions. You could say, well, ergo, Australia needs to have a more independent defence and strategic stance, that it needs to gear up for that, tool up for much more self-reliance. Or you might decide, well, no, we're going to find a way to essentially lock our powerful friend in and sort of require them, by virtue of integration with their whole global strategic stance, to be there with us in those moments, you know, to leverage off each other. And that essentially gives you the answer of AUKUS,
yes,
I suppose.
Yes. Look, that is exactly right. And in a sense, it's a restatement of what is in fact the oldest question in Australian defence policy. Do we depend on our great and powerful friends, or do we look after ourselves? And that's a particularly acute question for us, because we're so far from our great and powerful friends.
Yes.
If you're Canada, you never wake up in the morning wondering whether America's actually going to bother defending you, because you're right next door.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, the Canadians have their problems, but it's not that they fear of being abandoned by the United States.
No, no. I mean, that the US would defend Canada's northern border as vigorously as it would its own border.
Because, you know, it in effect strategically is America's northern border. Mm. Whereas for Australia, going right back, you know, right back into the 19th century, Australians have always been extremely conscious of the fact that Britain first and then America are very far from us, and therefore they don't have that kind of automatic identity of strategic interests which geographic proximity gives you. And so, you know, we've always worried, we've always asked ourselves a question, can we depend on our allies, or must we defend ourselves? And we've always found a dilemma, being that we're never sure we can depend on our allies because they're so far away. And we're never sure we can defend ourselves because the continent's so big and we're so few, and and you know, we don't feel strong enough. So that we're facing exactly that same dilemma again now. Do we go all in to support the United States as the United States tries to push back against China and preserve US leadership, or do we go all in to prepare ourselves for the world, for the region in which the United States has failed to do that?
Yeah.
And we find ourselves in a region that's dominated, and I might say not just dominated by China. We're going to live in an Asia which is dominated by two or three great powers, China, right, India, and eventually, I think, Indonesia. And
which is actually probably better than being dominated by one.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, particularly for countries like us, because just thinking about India and China for a moment, we're going to sit on the boundary line between a Chinese and an Indian sphere of influence.
Don't tell me we're going to be forced to choose again.
Well, no, the beauty of sitting on a boundary line is, you know, I call this the Mongolian school of strategic diplomacy. You know, Mongolia sits there between Russia and China and looks both ways and holds them both out at arm's length.
Yeah, right.
And it's the sort of classic, you know, sort of boundary state, buffer state position. Yeah. And Australia is going to be in the happy position, if we play our cards right, that we'll be able to use the Indians to play off against the Chinese and the Chinese to play off against the Indians. I think, you know, one of the mistakes we're making at the moment is we're not recognising that we face an Asia with two, so say, or three great powers, and that that's going to be much more complex, but also, in a sense, much more manageable than the idea of us just sitting under a Chinese sphere of influence, you know, as if we have no alternative. Now, you know, that's the difference between us and, say, you know, Vietnam, which is going to just sort of sit right under China's shadow. And, of course, the Vietnamese have got their own millennia of history how they manage that. And, I think the Vietnamese know what they're doing there. But their predicament is going to be different from ours. So that's, you know, that's the good news. But it does mean that, you know, my own view is that at the moment our governments are making the mistake of trying to do both of those things. As you mentioned, you know, AUKUS is absolutely a statement that we are aligning ourselves with the United States in the United States' efforts to deter China from its challenge and to prepare to fight if that deterrence fails. And plenty of other elements. If you look at the Defence Strategic Review the government published last year, lots of the language was about supporting the United States. On the other hand, some of the other language was about maximising our independent capacity to defend ourselves unaided. And I think the problem with that is, although it's a very natural policy thing for any government faced with a choice between option A and option B, saying we want to do both, the fact is, I don't think we can do both. They call for very different kinds of forces.
They do, yeah.
You know, that option A, support the United States all the way, requires us to build an ADF which is designed primarily to project power against China.
Yeah.
Whereas option B, defending ourselves, demands that we build an ADF that prevents China projecting power against us.
Mm.
And they really do pull us in very different directions, as indeed the AUKUS proposal and, for that matter, the way we're thinking about the surface fleet indicate. Those choices absolutely reflect the dilemmas we face in trying to choose between those options.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that surface fleet proposal now, because there's going to be 11 new these numbers, I suppose, to people who are not sort of read into this stuff will probably be new, and for others they're more conversant with it. But 11 new general purpose frigates plus some what are called optionally crewed vessels. Crude. I don't mean crude as in crude. I mean as in what we used to call manned, which is another way of saying they're potentially going to be drone-like vessels. So this is fairly cutting edge, and I understand that the US is still in trials with these vessels. So in a way, we're sort of joining an experiment there too. I guess, you know, we're some way off actually committing to building them. That's subject to them being up to it. And as a result of all of that, we're going to take our what's called warships, which I presume you can correct me on this one, but I presume means ships capable of actually projecting force, military power, doing harm to an adversary, from 11 to 26, I think. So, you know, not far off sort of tripling the number. But we lose some frigates, the Anzac-class frigates. I think we lose two of the eight of those, and there'll be six Hunter-class frigates. This doesn't mean much to me, I must say, the difference between Hunter-class and Anzac, but six Hunter-class frigates instead of nine. pick any part of that and start informing me.
Yeah, look, it's a fascinating package they've put together, and to me, surprising and I think misguided in some pretty fundamental ways. Let's start with the big question. That is, what's the role of surface ships in modern naval warfare?
Yeah.
Now, the first thing to bear in mind is that no major powers have had a serious war at sea since the Americans defeated the Japanese in 1945. So we've gone through a very long period in which technologies have changed very fundamentally, apart from anything else. And so it's important to recognise that nobody really knows how wars at sea are going to be fought in future, a little bit like the way the First World War provided so many surprises to people because the great powers hadn't fought, more so in some ways, because there had at least been some major land wars in Europe in the decades before that. But having said that, one trend which seems really clear is that progressively over a long time, surface ships have become more and more vulnerable. For very simple reasons. That is, they become easier and easier to find.
You can see them, right?
Exactly. And, you know, if you go back to sort of, you know, great age of battleships in the First World War or before, you know, the way you found a surface ship was to send a bloke up to the top of the mast with a pair of binoculars.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, these days it's done from space or from drones or whatever.
I know. I watched Master and Commander again over summer in a holiday house, and it just happened to be one of the few movies.
That is the point. You know, if you look at the history of naval warfare, most of the time, and right up into the Second World War, in fact, most of the time, most of the ships spent their time just looking for one another.
Yeah, peering through the mist.
You know, a ship is a very big thing.
Yeah.
But the ocean is very, very big, and it's very easy to get lost in it. And so, you know, if you look at the Battle of Coral Sea or the Battle of Midway, for example, you know, the sort of quintessential climactic battles of the Pacific War, naval battles of the Pacific War, you know, it was all about, were you lucky enough to find the other guy's carriers?
Yeah.
And this is even the case with – But that issue is now gone.
Yeah, this was even the case with Pearl Harbor, because those planes were off aircraft carriers.
Exactly. Right? Whereas now finding a surface ship is – you know, operationally almost trivial.
Right.
The second point is they're much easier to hit than they used to be. You know, again, a ship is a big target, but it does move, albeit fairly slowly.
Yeah.
And if you look at the, you know, naval battles of the Second World War, which again is the last time there was a major, you know, campaign between great powers, you know, you'd send in wave after wave, dozens of aircraft would go in, and if they were lucky, they put two or three bombs onto their target.
Mm.
Now, the good news is, from the attacker's point of view, two or three bombs is enough to sink an aircraft carrier. Mm. But it was, you know, really hard to do. These days, once you've found it, you can hit it.
Mm.
You know, now, of course, the ships put up defences, but the defences are relatively easy to overwhelm. You send in a dozen million-dollar anti-ship cruise missiles, and the ship's defences will shoot down the first half dozen of them. Mm. The last half dozen will get through. And so, you know, this represents a very deep, long-term, so to speak, structural trend that surface ships have become more and more vulnerable. They therefore have to spend more and more on their own defences. They become more and more expensive, and they become less and less effective at hurting the other guy.
Yeah, this is Paul Keating's line, that a whole lot of surface ships, if we were in a conflict with China, would be just taken out quite quickly.
Look, that is exactly right. And I think this is a worldwide trend. It's a very hard trend for navies to accommodate institutionally. But, you know, for example, the United States is still building and commissioning new aircraft carriers.
But
the interesting point is, when the Chinese build aircraft carriers, I think they're building them against the day when they've got the Americans out of Asia and they're trying to keep control of the rest of us.
Right.
In other words, they want to use their aircraft carriers the way the Americans have been using US aircraft carriers in places like the Gulf, where they don't face a major maritime adversary.
Yeah, right.
But in a major war between very capable maritime forces, like a US-China war over Taiwan would be, I don't think the Americans will put the carriers in harm's way, because they're just too vulnerable. And of course, if the carriers are held off far enough that they're not going to be vulnerable to Chinese missiles and aircraft and submarines, they're going to be too far away for their aircraft to be able to reach the targets.
Mm.
They're just on a cruise. I mean, my argument for a long time has been that for Australia to invest heavily in surface ships is just to put ourselves on the wrong side of that defensive-offensive balance, that we should be aiming to maximise our capabilities in much less vulnerable and much less expensive platforms like submarines and aircraft and missiles. So my starting point in response to what the government announced a couple of weeks ago is that to go from 11 major surface combatants, as they call them, to 26 is just heading in the wrong direction.
Right.
What we should be doing is maximising our capacity to find and sink the other guy's ships by investing in aircraft, in drones, in missiles, and in submarines, though not nuclear-powered ones, and leave the surface ships to the targets. Now, that's the first point. The second point is that, you know, the starting point for the surface fleet review that was commissioned in the follow-up to the Defence Strategic Review, which is where all this process began, were some very deep uncertainties about the Hunter-class project, which is the big project that was initiated by the previous government, to build a class of 9 very big ships, 10,000-tonne ships. So that's 3 times the size of the ANZAC ships. And this turned out to be a very troubled project.
So just on that, what's the analog for that? Would you call that a battleship? Is it a destroyer?
In old-fashioned terms, it's the size of a cruiser. So it's not the size of, you know, a battleship might have been 15 in the days when they had battleships.
Yeah, right.
They'd be 15 or 20,000 tons, but a cruiser would be 10,000 tons.
Right.
And it's a big ship. They're being called frigates, but frigates used to be 2,000 tons or 3,000 tons. Mm. There's a sort of inflation about going on here.
They're going like our cars, just getting bigger and bigger.
Exactly. Well, Navy guys like to use small names for big ships because I think that'll fool us into thinking that we're not spending too much money. but it's absurd to call a 10,000-ton ship a frigate. But it was called the Future Frigate when the project was initially launched, yeah. A bit of alliteration, I guess, and that name stuck. Now, a lot of people expected this government to cancel or very sharply scale back the Hunter-class project. As I say, they're going to be extremely expensive ships. There are lots of technical problems. It's unclear that they're, although they're very big, they're actually not very well armed. And there's been enormous delays already. When the project was announced in 2016 or 17, it was argued they were going to start cutting steel in 2020. Well, it's now 2024 and they haven't begun. So, you know, it's
part of the course, really.
But it's unnerving to have so many problems emerge so early on in the life of a project.
Yeah.
And it was widely believed that the Defence Strategic Review, the independent review that the government got done before they published their DSR last year, recommended that it either be scrapped completely or scaled back very substantially. Instead, the government decided to go ahead with 6 of the 9 ships.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that seems an odd decision because nobody really thinks these ships are going to be worth what they're going to cost us and are what we need. So,
well, this is what's been recommended, I think, by what is US Vice Admiral retired William Hillarides. Is it not? Isn't that the government's decision?
We haven't seen his report. We've seen the government's announcement. I don't know what he recommended, but I just make the observation here that I wouldn't necessarily trust the US Navy to get this stuff right. They're still building aircraft carriers.
Yes, good point.
You know, and actually the USN, doctrinally, the USN is saying, oh, no, we're going to move away from big ships to smaller ships. They just keep on building the bigger ships because they can't help themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the other reasons, industrial processes, you know, so on. A lot of institutional
politics
and political momentum around it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't think the idea that if you want to get the right answer on a point of naval force structure and automatically ask an American, I'm not sure that's necessary. I mean, I don't know anything about this guy. Might be great, but I think it's very odd that successive governments in recent years have fallen into the habit of seeking core defence policy advice from foreigners.
Yes.
Who don't understand our strategic situation as well as Australian officials should, at least.
It's not really a great vote of confidence in our local capacity to do that, is it? Let's just – probably now's a good time for a break because we're a bit overdue one, but we'll come back to this.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Discussion in a moment.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. When we were, I'm talking with Hugh Wyatt, of course, when we were, just before the break, we were discussing this idea of sort of outsourcing at least some of the sort of strategic and future experts or strategic thinking and expertise about how we structure our defence forces. It raises a question also, the way we're going about this, the formula we've just talked about, as to whether there's a big gamble here. It's a gamble that seems to also underpin AUKUS, which is that the sort of things that you were discussing in the first half, that is what could happen around Taiwan, won't happen in this decade.
Yeah, that's
because,
right.
Because we're not really going to be in any sort of capacity, upgraded capacity as a result of this naval surface plan. Before the sort of probably mid-2030s.
No, look, that's exactly right. We'll just begin to get new ships in the 2030s.
Yes.
Look, it's a really important point. The fact is that we have, you know, our governments have just in the last couple of years woken up to the fact that there's a fundamental decline in our strategic circumstances we were discussing.
Yeah.
And the fact is that's about 10 or 15 years too late. I mean, you even go back into the 90s, Australian defence policy documents were identifying the fact that the long-term trends were for China's power to grow, its ambitions to grow with it, Asia to become more contested, big future challenges for our defence policy. The 2000 defence white paper, which I had a lot to do with, quite explicitly acknowledged that this was going to put new kinds of demands on our force structure. And then if you look forward to the 2009 white paper, which was Kevin Rudd's white paper, it was very explicit. I mean, so explicit it infuriated the Chinese in saying that Australia needed to fundamentally rethink its maritime posture because we're going to be living in a much more demanding maritime strategic environment. And so at one level, governments have been kind of acknowledging these sorts of changes for a long time. But we've done nothing about it. You know, Kevin Rudd's white paper famously came in saying we have to do all this new stuff. And then 2 weeks later, they cut the defence budget. And that's kind of been the pattern. And so the fact is that we are now, just now, really starting to take this stuff seriously, or at least talking about taking it seriously, when it's already, if not too late, then certainly a long way into the game. We will face the challenges of the next decade, roughly speaking, with the forces we have. And that applies to the surface fleet. We should have started building our future surface fleet a decade ago, and it applies to our submarines. We should have started building our future submarines a decade or more ago.
On that Hunter class decision to go from, what was it, nine to six. Yeah. I wonder whether, and this is probably a question more in my bailiwick than yours, but I wonder whether the fact that, you know, Kevin Rudd did have that white paper talking about upgrading our defence and then cut defence spending shortly after. I mean, this government is sort of in many ways a function in a lot of its decision making of the lessons learned through that period. Just like the Hawke-Keating government was very much a kind of a modification of what happened in the Whitlam period, what worked and also what didn't and how to do it better. I wonder whether Labor is just very, very careful about not being seen to cut defence spending. And so we're going with those frigates, those Hunter-class bloated frigates, because to not do so would be a gift to Peter Dutton, and who's obviously seen as a real hawk on defence.
Yeah, look, I think that's a very important part of it. I think overall Labor is extremely nervous about being seen to be soft on defence. So they therefore feel the need to demonstrate their credentials, and I think there is a significant they've taken some significant fire on that issue because they produced a defence strategic review last year. They've echoed their predecessors' language about us being the most demanding strategic circumstances since 1945, and yet very little seems to be going on. And I think, you know, Richard Miles in particular has been subject to quite a lot of criticism for that, and I think justifiably so. But I think even more particularly, they've been very nervous about South Australia, because the Hunter class was promised to South Australia. They're going to be built in South Australia. And I suspect a significant factor in the government's decision was that although they wanted to step back from the Hunter class to some extent, they felt they needed to keep a big build of Hunters going because that's what the South Australians had been promised. And politicians in Canberra seem convinced that the South Australians will make or break governments on the basis of how many tons of steel are being cut in the shipyards in Port Adelaide.
It's been a factor in elections for
a long
virtually
time.
This whole since
yeah.
the turn
well,
of the century.
Well, ever since Kim Beazley accepted the contractor's recommendation to build the Collins class submarines.
That's
in Adelaide,
right. Yeah, yeah.
It's become, I think, a very central to South Australia's self identity almost.
Yeah.
Its sort of image of itself.
Yeah, it's
and
gone
so
from the sort of arts and wine
yeah,
state
right.
to the
yeah,
sort of defence technology.
Defence technology state.
Yeah.
And that, I think, has, you know, distorts force structure decisions, makes us buy things we don't need because it's regarded as politically important to build them.
And it commits us to this idea of continuous shipbuilding because
yes.
of the so-called valley of death argument that you can't have a workforce that suddenly doesn't have a contract and everyone
right.
leaves and, you know, it sends the economy south. So you then have an acquisition program that is, which is where you were going with your point about America
exactly.
as well, which is sort of substantially influenced by its economic impact.
You find yourself buying ships not because you think that's the best way to fight, but because you want to keep shipyards in business for fear of losing votes. And, I mean, that's not unique to Australia.
No.
But our force structure has been very strongly influenced, and our continued big investment in what I would regard as operationally suboptimal surface ships has been very much driven by this desire to maintain a continuous build of warships. But Labor has taken that one step further because the previous government, and for that matter the government before that, had pledged continuous build of warships in South Australia. Labor has now promised continuous build of warships in Western Australia as well.
Well, you see, there were four seats that came across to Labor in the last election. They
yes.
were really arguably the four seats that delivered Albanese
yeah.
the majority.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly that's the way it looked on election night because
yes.
their polls close a couple of hours later and you don't find out. But
yeah.
they didn't expect to have those such success,
yeah.
I don't think,
that's
in
right.
WA. And Albanese's visited there a number of times since. He spends half his time, well,
yeah.
it's an
yeah.
exaggeration, but he's frequently over on the West Coast. So you can see politics influencing
yeah,
all of this.
Yeah, very much. And the fact is that we are, you know, as a result, we're buying surface ships that we don't need. And
which is a pretty serious.
Well, the first principle of defence policy is that every dollar can only be spent once.
Yeah.
And every dollar we spend on surface ships is a dollar we're not spending on aircraft or missiles or drones or submarines.
Hmm.
And, you know, and which are the forces that we really do need. And in a conflict with a major, highly capable air and maritime adversary, as China will be in the decades ahead, as India will be in the decades ahead, we'll keep our surface ships at home. We won't send them to sea because the chance of them being sunk with a crew of 150 or 200 or 250 are just too high.
Yeah, that's a chilling sort of reality.
Well, and the other reality is that the work that they can do, the munitions they can deliver, can be delivered more cheaply, more cost-effectively, more safely by other platforms, by aircraft or drones or submarines.
Yeah, right.
You know, in the end, the ship just carries the weapons to within range of the target, and the cheaper ways of carrying the weapons to within range of the target.
So is there a mismatch or an inconsistency between our defence acquisitions and the strategic policy that communicates, that expresses, and our foreign policy, which, I mean, we've got the ASEAN meeting happening in Melbourne, wrapping up just as we record this today. You know, it's all about sort of integration in the nation and relationships and so forth. But we, of course, have just, one, we've just been talking about the surface ships plan. We're committed to AUKUS, which is very much to the sort of US projection of power in this region. If we think about it in terms of that binary that Keating used to talk about, sort of security in Asia or security from Asia, we look like on the defence side, we're doing the security from Asia, and in foreign policy, or at least in our diplomacy, we are saying, no, we're a member of this club. This is where we live.
Look, I think that's exactly right. The fact is that we mentioned before that there are these sort of two great ideas in Australian defence and strategic policy. We either support our allies, great and powerful friends, or we try to look after ourselves. And this has a kind of a diplomatic analogue as well. You know, as Australia confronts the rising power of China and of other Asian great powers, we recognise that there's, you know, it's a huge challenge to the order, you know, Asia, the way Asia works. And we have a pretty simple choice. We either try and hang on to the old order, which means hanging on to the United States as a dominant power in Asia, doing everything we can to support them diplomatically as well as militarily. Or on the other hand, we recognize that just the sheer shift in the distribution of wealth and power, which is, you know, such a huge feature of our era, means that America is not going to dominate the Western Pacific the way it used to, that we will live in a region in which Asian powers, and not just the great powers, but also powers like, you know, other countries in Southeast Asia, are going to have more power and more weight relative to Australia, are going to be more influential. And so instead of trying to hang on to US primacy, we start to do whatever we can to contribute to the development of a new order in Asia, which acknowledges and accepts and accommodates that greater power of our Asian neighbours. Now, just as in the defence space, I said before that we're trying to have a bob each way. We're sort of thinking we can go all the way with America on the one hand and also try to prepare to defend ourselves independently on the other. You could say something the same about our diplomacy, because a lot of our diplomacy looks and sounds and smells like we're just all the way with the United States. And if you hear Albanese, for example, talking, and I think there is a significant difference in tone, at least, between what Albanese says and what Wong says. But if you listen to Albanese, it's just America. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't think that would be a bad policy if I thought America had any chance of succeeding. But I just don't think it's going to work. Yeah. On the other hand, Wong.
Nor do most Americans, it seems.
No, well, that's right.
It's just a complete loss of faith.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And based on something really fundamental. I mean, the shift in distribution of wealth and power, the fact that China now has an economy which on the most relevant measure is bigger than America's, you know, that is just a huge fact that we are still not quite getting our heads around. I mean, we're happy enough to sell them, you know, whatever it is, 2 million tonnes of iron ore a day, but we haven't worked out what that really means in terms of the way the world works. But on the other hand, see, when you listen to Penny Wong, for example, some of the things she's been saying in the context of the ASEAN summit, she talks about looking for balance in the region where no one country dominates and no country is dominated. And she sometimes, at different times, talks about the need for a new order in the region and the need for America to have a new role. In other words, she sounds as though she's doing the other thing. She's envisaging Australia contributing to a regional process whereby we in the region, in Asia, to use Keating's, half of Keating's phrase, build a new order in the region which accommodates and recognises and accepts the power of our Asian neighbours and, so to speak, lets go of the fantasy of perpetual American dominance. But the trouble is that there's a real tension there, and the trouble is the government's made no effort to resolve that tension.
Yeah, well, there's a tension almost in the government is what you're saying.
Exactly.
As well.
In fact, I think there is. I think Penny Wong, to be honest, in her heart of hearts, understands that the one-eyed support for the United States, the hope that the United States can perpetuate its primacy in Asia indefinitely, which is right at the heart of AUKUS.
I think
she understands that's wrong.
Yeah.
Last year for an essay I wrote for the Monthly, I went back and read every speech she's given since she became foreign affairs spokesperson in 2016 and read very carefully the ones in which she talked about this issue. And a lot of it's pretty good stuff. You know, I mean, she has really thought about this stuff.
Yes.
And I suspect that, you know, because she's a very intelligent person.
Very cerebral, yeah.
Very cerebral and you know, a real thinker. And I think the thinker in her understands that what you might call the AUKUS strand of Australian policy is non-viable, but the politician in her is reluctant to take that debate on because it is so traumatic.
I wonder if this, if it's, AUKUS isn't the bloke's policy and you know, a new class of politician, which in some ways Wong embodies, understands this in a less historical context, but in a much more.
Let me suggest a slightly different dichotomy. I think there's a generational thing here.
Mm. Well, I think it's a both, actually.
Well, you might well be right about the gender thing, but I think there's a – what strikes me is that the generation of politicians, of whom Albanese is one, who – so it's became of age politically in the 1990s, in that era where America seemed to be the new Rome. Yeah, you know, people were talking about it as a hyperpower. People seriously believed at the end of the Cold War that we were going to live for as far ahead as we could see in a global order dominated by unchallengeable American preponderance in every dimension of national power. And this was great. It was good. And it was great. Yeah. I mean, if it had happened, you know, there's not a skerrick of anti-Americanism in me. I would love to live in a world that was dominated by the United States, at least compared to any of the others I can imagine. But it's just not there. And I think that generation, which Albanese, I think, is a great, but I think Marles is very much the same, that generation have not yet let go of the idea that American primacy is perpetual. And I think Wong is actually really part of that generation too. She's just a bit of a deeper thinker. But what strikes me is that there's a younger generation, people who are now in Parliament, some of them are in Cabinet, who came of age in the 2010s with the failures of in Iraq and Afghanistan and all of that.
Yeah.
And who have, so to speak, grown up with a powerful China. Powerful China is not a sort of an innovation for them. It's part of the landscape, who I think have a vivider sense of how far Asia is today and will be in future from the idea of an Asia which could be dominated and made safe for us Australia, by our Anglo-Saxon great and powerful friends. And it's that generation that I think we're going to rely on to resolve these contradictions and to start doing what we really need to be doing. And that is the old Keating idea.
Yeah.
Because, you know, right at the heart of that formulation that Keating used, which I might say was first used by Bob Hawke.
Oh, is that right?
Right at the heart of that was a recognition that eventually the rising powers of Asia would rise to the point where we could not expect our great and powerful friends to keep us as safe as they had in the past. That was something that the generation of Bob Hawke and Paul Keating really, really understood. And that's what drove the whole thing about, you know, enmeshment with Asia. And that's what drove their sense that we need to get closer and closer to Southeast Asia, because that was going to be our way of managing our relations with these great powers. Now, you know, what's striking about the ASEAN summit that we've seen unfolding over the last few days is how much evidence there is of how far Australia is from our Southeast Asian neighbours, because there is no skerrick in Southeast Asia of a desire to support the United States in a United States effort to contain China's challenge and preserve U.S. primacy.
Not even the Philippines?
Not even the Philippines. You know, if you look at some of the language that Marcos used in his speech to Parliament,
yes,
that was pretty spicy.
Mm-hmm.
Then when pressed on it by Sarah Ferguson on 7:30, backed right off.
Yeah.
You know, the Philippines is not a country with a strong tradition of strategic steadfastness. And I think, you know, the idea that any of the Southeast Asian countries would support the United States in a war with China, and that's what this boils down to. I mean, this is not just all diplomacy. In the end, this is a question of where will these guys stand when things get rough? And, this is not Europe. In Europe, there's a strong presumption that if the United States goes to war in Europe, NATO will go with them. There is no analog here. America, I think Americans like to think, Washington likes to delude itself that it's building a tight coalition of countries to help it contain China. They're not there.
But, yeah, that's a very good point. But that brings me, I suppose, in the few moments we've got left to think about the possibilities nonetheless for Australia, thinking about Australia as a separate entity from the US and hopefully being seen to the extent that it's currently possible as a separate entity from the United States in the region. We have those comments from Bongbong Marcos. We have the antipathy, suspicion that the Vietnamese feel, and we have good relations. We're elevating their relationship to a comprehensive strategic partnership. We've got Indonesia, which I think is, for a range of reasons, potentially much more can be done with that relationship. We know there's great suspicion in Malaysia and Indonesia, or great hostility, really, to the West's interpretation of what's going on in the Middle East, the failure to do something to stop the slaughter of Palestinians. And so I think there's some common ground there, not just geographically, not just in terms of proximity. There are common interests, and is that our leverage in extending our reach and sort of entrenching our membership as a legitimate Southeast Asian region nation?
Look, it absolutely is, because you know in the long run, I think we have a very robust set of shared interests with the other small and medium powers in Southeast Asia in managing our relations with the great powers, and particularly, you know, with China and India, because, you know, we are all going to have to live with them. And so I think there's a very deep opportunity for us, imperative for us, to work with them to work out how we collectively manage our great neighbours, our powerful neighbours. Now, that's not to say that what we should do is to think of that as an alliance against the great neighbours. That's just not going to happen. It's not going to be as binary as that. And I think in particular what we have to recognise is that it's going to be very episodic. There will be some issues on which our interests will align closely with Vietnam, say, and so we'll work with Vietnam. There'll be some issues in which our interests will align with Indonesia, and we'll work with Indonesia. We shouldn't have a model that what we're going to do is to form some sort of block which will hold together come what may.
Yeah, unrealistic.
It's unrealistic. And that's not what ASEAN is. I mean, one of the problems we have is, and the Southeast Asians are partly responsible for this, is that we tend to lazily think of Southeast Asia just as a blob called ASEAN. Mm. It's not. It's a very complex set of countries which themselves have very diverse interests and very diverse positions, including their geographical relationship.
And some historical tensions. Yeah.
And you know, some of them, you know, they have a lot of different attitudes towards China. They have different attitudes towards the United States. But what they all have in common is that they don't see it as viable to line up alongside the United States in trying to contain China. And Australia's problem in our diplomacy in Southeast Asia is, despite mellifluous phrases that Penny Wong occasionally uses, in the end, the heart of Australian strategic diplomacy in Southeast Asia for the last decade or so has been to go to our neighbours and read Washington's talking points to them. and you know, that does not work. Now, these are very polite people, our neighbours, and so, with the possible exception, for example, of Anwar Ibrahim of Malaysia in his remarks in Melbourne a couple of days ago, which were pretty blunt, and we're used to Malaysian leaders being blunt.
We are. But
Singaporean language has been the same. A famous occasion when Lee Hsien Loong stood next to Scott Morrison, as Scott Morrison was heading off to the G7 in Cornwall, where we now know he did the deal in AUKUS, and sort of looked him straight in the eye and said, you know, you have to learn to get on with China. He wagged his finger a bit, metaphorically at least. So, and you know, that's certainly the view in Indonesia. Nobody in Indonesia thinks it's a smart idea for any country in the region to line up alongside the United States in attempting to contain China's challenge and push China back into the box. They all accept that China is going to play a much bigger role in the region. They're not so really happy about it, but they acknowledge the realities of power. And that's something that we have yet to acknowledge. And I think that is, you know, a real failing on our part. And I think there's a reason for that. You know, it goes back to where we started, really. Ever since European settlement, we've always believed that our relationship with the region we live in would be mediated for us by our great and powerful friends. And I think we're still, as a country, finding it extraordinarily difficult to come to terms with the fact that we are going to have to make our way in this region by ourselves.
There's so much more we could talk about here. I mean, that raises even things like the idea of a republic, for example.
Oh,
what
yes.
it says about
yes.
us is that yes. we can't even, you yes. know, get rid of the
can't
sort
even,
of
can't even do
can't
that.
Even change the letterhead, really. Let alone, you know,
that's right. Let alone change the business.
Yeah, that's
quite
right.
Right.
Yeah, Hugh White, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you. Always is. Really enjoyed it. Learned a huge amount. Thanks for being on Democracy Sausage again.
Well, thank you, Mark. Great to be back with you.
We'll look forward to talking to you again.
There'll be plenty to talk about.
That is Democracy Sausage for this week. I'm Mark Kenny. Thanks for your time, and we look forward to another interesting discussion next week. Bye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.